Hi, this is Bill Meyer. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. You can hear the show every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon Central, and there are many more podcasts for this and all of our other faith radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
A psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer Live.
And welcome. It is so great to have you with us today on this Saturday. Thanks for taking Faith Radio with you wherever you might be in our listening area. We appreciate you giving us your trust. One of the things you know about this radio network, if you've listened very long, is that we have some of the most solid Bible teaching in the world. Some of the just fantastic teachers and preachers. And we appreciate them so much. I learn so much from so many of the programs that we air on this program, on this station. And by the way, today we are going to dive into the topic of apologetics. We're going to talk to a guy who works with University Christian Fellowship, who actually lives here in the Twin Cities and travels around the country. And he will help us to learn how to be more powerful, effective, confident when we are talking to people who don't believe in Jesus Christ. And, of course, there are more and more. I think all of us probably have somebody in our family, at our workplace, in our neighborhood that we know who is a skeptic or an out-and-out atheist. And, you know, they may, if we really enter into a relationship with them, they may ask us some very hard questions about our Christian faith. And today, we're going to learn how to answer some of those questions. So stick with us as we dive into that topic with Rick Mattson with University Christian Fellowship in just a few minutes here on the Faith Radio Network. First, though, if you know me at all, I love to look at some of the recent research that comes out on how we live our lives, how we can best function, how we can be wise individuals. Like Proverbs says, you read so much in Proverbs from the Old Testament sage about, you know, the wise man does this, the fool does this. If you live this way, this is bound to happen. And what is constantly amazing to me is how scientific research backs up Scripture. We shouldn't be surprised at that because, you know, we have a God who knows us intimately, who designed the world, who knows how we best function. But it seems like every week I see something in the news or in the research that backs that up. It shows us that God is the architect of all creation. And I found this one about, and I don't know if this sounds familiar to you, but do you get into frequent arguments with your spouse, your friends, or your neighbors? Do you get into frequent arguments with your spouse, your friends, or your neighbors? If so, you could be slowly killing yourself. Yes, there is a new study out that found that middle-aged adults who frequently fought with their husband or wife were more than twice as likely to die at a relatively young age. Now, frequent fights with friends were even more hazardous. People who did this were 2.6 times more likely to die prematurely than people who got along with their friends. And worst of all was persistent fights with neighbors. The researchers found that people who did that were 3 times more likely to die prematurely. Now, even when there was no yelling or screaming involved, simply worrying about friends or loved ones or getting angry over their demands could be enough to shorten your life. Here's something else they found. People who always or often fretted about their spouse were almost twice as likely to die during the course of the study compared to people who seldom fretted or stressed with their spouse. And moms and dads, listen up. Parents who expended lots of negative mental energy on their children were 55% more likely to die prematurely compared to those who didn't stress and worry about their kids as often. Man, I tell you, and you know, they looked at both men and women in this study, and they found that actually guys are more likely to kick the bucket because of these arguments and stress. I guess it doesn't surprise me because they looked at things like cardiovascular disease, you know, dying of a heart attack or a stroke. Even cancer seems to be linked to this. Now, if any of those descriptions sound familiar to you, and of course all of us at times lose our temper, all of us at times have issues with our spouse or with our kids, but if this is an ongoing thing for you, if you some of the descriptions I read to you sound familiar, maybe it's time to see a Christian counselor. You know, Focus on the Family keeps a list of qualified, caring Christian therapists all around the country, and if you call them during the week, Monday through Friday, at their 800 number, they will give you the names of some people they've checked out right there in your community that you could go see. If you need to learn something like, I don't know, anger management, getting along with your spouse, how to be a more effective parent, these are folks that can help you. And the other thing is you want to be praying about this. And I'll speak for myself, something that I know with my kids. We have three young kids at home, and there are times where my wife and I lose our temper, and I lose my temper more than I want to admit, and it's something that I have to pray about. I have to ask God for His Holy Spirit to help me in my parenting journey with my wonderful kids who I love dearly but sometimes drive me nuts. And let me mention one other thing to you, in addition to the Focus on the Family counseling number, which is 1-800-A-FAMILY, 1-800-A-FAMILY. Again, call them Monday through Friday. They might be open on Saturdays. I'm not sure if they still do that or not. But if you call during the week, they will, and ask for counseling, they will be glad to talk to you. They'll do a 45-minute free phone counseling session with you, and then they'll give you the names of some qualified therapists in your area. And one other thing is there's a book that it's been out for several years. It's by Neil Clark Warren, a psychologist from Southern California. It's called Make Anger Your Ally. Make Anger Your Ally. Perhaps that's something that all of us could use help with. So anyway, hope that's helpful to you. It's 11 minutes past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. Coming up next, we dive into how to more effectively share our faith with unbelievers, those people in our sphere of influence in our life who don't know Him. And we'd like them to know Him, but sometimes they ask tough questions. And our guest has learned how to answer those questions in some very creative ways. We'll talk to Rick Mattson, the author of Faith is Like Skydiving, up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
I want to say hi to our great friends listening on Faith 1200 in Fargo-Moorhead. If you have tuned in on Faith 1270 in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, we appreciate it. Maybe you're listening to us in Madison, Wisconsin on Faith 1190, or in Duluth Superior on Faith 90.5, or right here in the Twin Cities and beyond on Faith 900. I forgot to mention our friends in Waterloo, Iowa. Thank you for listening on Faith 1090. We appreciate that. Wherever you might be on this Saturday, we appreciate you taking Faith Radio along. You can find our entire broadcast schedule at myfaithradio.com and some great articles that will help strengthen your faith and equip you as a believer. And speaking of equipping, if you ever get stuck trying to explain the Christian faith, you can use concrete analogies to make Christianity more plausible, more understandable. If someone, for example, claims that Christians make a blind leap of faith, you might say something like, well, faith is like skydiving. You check your parachute beforehand and make sure it's secure. You follow the safety instructions, and then you jump. It's not a blind leap. It's an informed leap. That is just one of the great analogies that Rick Mattson has come up with in his book, Faith is Like Skydiving. And the subtitle is, And Other Memorable Images for Dialogue with Seekers and Skeptics. Rick, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be here.
Such a pleasure to have you with us today. And I know you have a long background with an organization that I respect very, very much, and that's InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. Tell us a little bit about your background with InterVarsity, what you do, and what your daily and weekly life is like as an apologist and somebody who works with college students.
Yeah, I've been with InterVarsity now for over three decades in various roles. And my latest role, the last 5 years, Bill, I've served as a traveling evangelist and apologist to college campuses around the country. And wow, just feel like I'm really getting into my sweet spot here. It's just so fun to show up at Northwestern University or Michigan State or Arizona State and serve with our staff there and try to reach out to a lot of skeptics. So, you know, at Arizona State, roll in and on a Monday or a Tuesday, and the day kind of goes like this, maybe over the noon hour, and in the evening we'll have a session, kind of an outreach session. And often we call them Stump the Chump. And, Bill, I'm the chump. So students, they can come and ask any question they want about Christian faith. And my job then is to offer a thoughtful reply. And then during the day, I meet one-on-one or with small groups of students, some of whom have questions about faith and the Bible and God and, you know, all the hard objections they might be facing or might want to present to me. So noon and evening are the two sessions, and then during the day I meet with students one-to-one or in small groups. So, you know, our Christian students who are involved in InterVarsity might bring a friend in who's a skeptic or who's a seeker and has questions, and we just sit down in the student union and talk these things over. And that's why they pay me so much money, Bill, to do these things.
Okay, no, we know the truth. Yeah. You're like a missionary. Yeah. You really are. You're like a domestic missionary in many ways.
Yeah.
And we appreciate everybody who works for InterVarsity and the other Christian ministries that work on campus. You're doing such a wonderful work, Rick. Let me ask you, I'm guessing that over the years, and how many years did you say you've been doing this?
Well, I've been with InterVarsity for over three decades, let's put it that way.
Okay,
I'm young at heart, but I've got some graying hair.
No, that's fine. So over the 30 years, and particularly in the last 10, have you seen a significant change in the way Christians are treated on these campuses, the questions that come up, and the just the basic let's say, lack of understanding or lack of knowledge about a Christian worldview? Maybe that's a pretty obvious question, but how have you seen things change just as our society has kind of morphed and become more and more postmodern and frankly, in my opinion, anti-Christian?
Yeah, I think the Christian students incoming to campuses are less well-read than they used to be. They're less biblically literate than they used to be, unfortunately. So on the Christian side of things, we could definitely use an upgrade. On the non-Christian side of things, I think the rise of the new atheism has created more animosity toward Christianity. And by the new atheism, I mean Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, some of the others. They've really made a forceful and combative case against Christianity. Sometimes it's not even a case. Sometimes it's just shouting.
Yeah, they're pretty angry guys, from what I've read.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they really are. And then when you read the actual arguments, a lot of the arguments are pretty thin and pretty disappointing. So you do have that kind of antagonism toward Christianity that has taken on a new bite, I would say, the last 10, 15 years. And then just overall, the postmodern university is trying to tear down everything. It's trying to deconstruct everything. And so Christianity is definitely been in its sidelines for that. And deconstruction, you might say, the tearing down of Christianity, has definitely taken place on college campuses. And so people end up with a lot of negative stereotypes. And, you know, Bill, sometimes us Christians don't help those negative stereotypes.
Right.
When we do bad things that land in the media and so forth. But, yeah, I think the climate has changed. If incoming Christians were more literate in their own tradition, and if we were able to make a thoughtful reply both to the hardened skeptics, these new atheists, and to kind of the postmodern environment, we'd be better off. And I guess that's the direction that I'm trying to head, the work that I do.
Well, and I'm so thankful that you and others are doing this, Rick. You may know my friend David Wheaton from the Twin Cities area.
I do.
David, of course, is very involved in speaking to college students and helping to equip them, and even high school students who are going off to a secular university. I wonder sometimes, you mentioned your first concern is that Christian kids are not well-equipped, unprepared for what they're going to be facing on the college campus. And I have to lay the blame, and again, you challenge me on this, I lay the blame two places. I lay the blame at the feet of, unfortunately, many parents, Christian parents who are well-meaning, who care about their kids, but who have never taken the time to themselves learn about just the basics of Christian worldview or apologetics. I also lay the blame at, unfortunately, far too many youth groups that are all about pizza and volleyball and not about actually helping these young people. I mean, for crying out loud, if I'm a youth pastor, and I'm not, but let's say I was, and I have a bunch of high school seniors who are about to go off to University of Minnesota, University of Arizona, Michigan State, wherever that might be, and I know what they're going to be facing, I'm going to use that year, and hopefully not just their senior year, I would say all through high school, I would be working diligently to help them understand the basic tenets of their faith, how to articulate those tenets, how to defend their faith, and to do that in a winsome, caring, compassionate manner. But it is happening in some places. I don't want to, paint with a broad brush there. I know there's churches that are doing that, and I know there are some parents that are doing that. But by and large, in the average Christian home, most of the time is spent on 1,000 different activities, parents and kids running 1,000 different directions, and it's all about, and again, if you disagree with me, you challenge me on this, but I think for many, we have bought kind of into the world's view of success. So it's about achievement. It's about popularity. It's about physical attractiveness. It's the kids are hearing this constant, drumbeat from the media, from their peers, unfortunately, even from their parents sometimes when it comes to achievement, getting ahead, getting in the best college, getting the best job. And we're neglecting what's most important, and that's our relationship with God. You agree?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's a concerted effort. It takes pastors and youth ministers and parents, Christian educators in the church, all of them working together, because if they're not all kind of on the same page with that, there's going to be leakage. There's going to be problems. And, you know, when the senior pastor supports the youth minister in the kind of training that you were just mentioning, and when the councils and elder boards and leaders in the church support the youth minister in that, that would be extremely empowering. But I think there's a lot of pressure on youth ministers these days. You know, there's pressure on them to attract big numbers and have big programs and be successful. And, you know, I know youth ministers, it feels like they've got 300 bosses.
And they got to put on a good show, don't they, Rick? They've got to put on a really good show to get those kids in there.
Yeah,
and it's all about lights and sound and music and whoopee-doo.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I know a big church here in the Twin Cities where I live, and they do a great job getting students in the door because they put a lot of money into it, a lot of effort. There's a lot of food. There's a lot of music and recreation and so forth. And then once you get them there, then the training needs to begin. So what I'm afraid of is that if you don't do some of those attractive things, students will never show up in the first place. But I think to your point is once they're there, then what are we doing with them? And is there support from parents, Christian educators, church leaders, pastors, for youth ministries to engage in this part, in this training? And then secondly, Bill, you also mentioned the home, what's happening in the home. And, you know, I think Christian parents often don't feel very equipped to train their kids. And so then that gets back to the church. What are pastors and church leaders doing to equip parents to equip their kids? You know, so I think the whole thing has to work together. And when you have this concerted effort in the church to train young people, I think we can really get somewhere. But when it's just the parents or just the youth minister or just the senior pastor, that's when, you know, things are not going to happen like they should.
I'm with you 100%, Rick, on all of those things. And we both know, you and I both know, there are lots of resources that are available to families that unfortunately parents are not taking advantage of, and maybe the church is not taking advantage of, and we maybe can dive into some of those. One is your book, How Faith is Like Skydiving, and we're going to get into the book here in just a bit, but one other concern I want to mention, and I'm kind of on a soapbox today, but this does trouble me, especially when I think of what kids are facing on these secular college campuses, and that is how much time the average Christian student, high school student, junior high school student, and their parents are spending with technology and social media and in front of the television and playing video games. And I believe, and again, you challenge me if you don't agree, I believe Satan is using these things. Not that any of them are bad in and of themselves, but he is cleverly, he's the father of lies. He is cleverly using these things to eat up our time, and we're entertaining ourselves to death. And because of that, we're not engaging with the life of the mind. We're not equipping ourselves to be able to be an effective evangelist. And that troubles me greatly, Rick. We've just got about a minute and a half left, but weigh in on that if you would.
Yeah. You know, I think if our churches are creating a culture of learning among the parents, and if the parents then can create a culture of learning among the kids, we can either limit access and limit time in social media, or sometimes integrate it and use it for the furtherance of education. And, you know, a mixture of those two is probably the reality for a lot of families. And, you know, you go on Facebook, there's some really great Facebook sites that are about apologetics. And if you go on other social media, there is Christian influences there on the internet and so forth, some great websites. And so combining, you know, integrating some of the social media into our learning environment, that's part of the answer. And then, as you say, avoiding these distractions where it's just endless hours in front of the media, social media is another thing we need to do. But I think it gets back to the church. The church needs to create a culture of learning among families, and then the families can carry it out. Because just left to themselves, boy, it's pretty tough to invent this stuff when your parents just working on your own.
Rick, we're going to take a quick break here for our network, and we're going to dive into your book. As I said, dive into Faith is Like Skydiving.
Nice.
And some, that is really bad. Some of the analogies that Rick will teach us coming up here on the Faith Radio Network. Stick with us.
Continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
Hey, and if you call us in the next 30 minutes or so, we'll put you into a drawing for a copy of Rick Mattson's book, Faith is Like Skydiving. We have three copies to give away. We'd love to give one to you, especially if you are in church leadership, if you are a Christian parent, an educator, if you're a young person who's preparing to go off to college. This book will just be a tremendous addition to your library. Faith is Like Skydiving and Other Memorable Images for Dialogue with Seekers and Skeptics. The author is Rick Mattson. And Rick, we live in a day when story tends to carry the argument, the old-fashioned way of evangelism, and I'm not criticizing the four spiritual laws or some of the other methods, but those methods of I'm going to give you, you know, these steps, and I'm going to give you a very left brain argument. Unfortunately, in this day and age, when the other side, the anti-Christian side, tends to use emotion and story, the left brain stuff just ain't cutting it anymore. And I think you've realized that, and that's one of the reasons you wrote this book, isn't it?
Yeah, when I first went out on the road and I was doing apologetics and I was doing these sessions called Stump the Chump, or sometimes we call them Questions Cafe, I would have these classic arguments that I would trot out, and they're fairly abstract and sometimes hard to follow and so forth. And I just realized I was putting college students to sleep with these arguments. So I started to develop concrete images and illustrations and analogies that were memorable, not only for the students that I was talking to, but quite frankly for me when I was on the spot and having to give replies to hard questions and objections. So once you get things a little bit more concrete, you can kind of almost build the arguments around the concrete image, and then everyone can remember them a lot better. And Bill, you mentioned storytelling. I mean, Jesus was a master storyteller, and he was the master at using concrete images and analogies, a lot of them from, you know, farming and religion and taxation and so forth in first century Palestine. And that way people could remember what he was saying, and that's what we're trying to do here.
And we have such a great model in Jesus as storyteller, and unfortunately we don't often utilize that model, and we can certainly contemporize it to our current culture. And I'd love to get into some of those analogies, because I do think they're wonderful, and you can unpack each one of them for us and tell us how we can use those analogies in a conversation with an atheist, agnostic, with a skeptic. Hell is like an empty pub. I love that. How is hell like an empty pub, Rick?
Well, this gets back a bit to the view of hell. There's various views on hell, but to a kind of C.S. Lewis image of hell as being the absence of God. And I'd be quick to say, yeah, it's the absence of God. It might be worse than that, too. But if you just kind of go with a minimalist definition here of hell being a place where God is not, then hell is like an empty pub. And here on Earth, you know, you kind of hear this sentiment among secular people. They'll say, hey, I'd rather party in hell than get bored in heaven. I don't want to sit on clouds and play a harp in heaven. I want to go to hell and party with my friends. And so the empty pub image says that the God who made hell and who is the God of community is absent in hell. And so community itself is absent in hell. And hell is a lonely, empty place. So you show up at the bar expecting to party with your friends. Yeah, there's booze there, but you're going to be drinking alone day after day, week after week, month after month, into eternity. And what you thought was going to be a wonderful time with all your party friends, you're now going to be isolated, because the God of community is not present, and his gifts of community are not present in hell. And, you know, you can read a lot of C.S. Lewis on this and get more about this idea of the absence of God. But I just find it hits really hard, Bill, with kind of the young generation who are so much into their friends and into their community. The idea of being isolated in eternity, I think, is a really good image.
It's kind of like being in solitary confinement. You think about this U.S. soldier who was recently held by the Taliban for a number of years, and we believe that a good portion of that time he was just in this cage, cut off from all human contact. And regardless of what you think of that particular story and what this young man's actions might have been prior to that, putting any human being in solitary confinement, and we just know from the research what that does. And you're right. So many young people, it's all about community. It's their tribe. It's their buds. It's, you know, it's friends with benefits. Yeah, they're peeps. And they're not going to, they're just going to be lonely. And it's a just vast wasteland. And we think certainly there's probably going to be some other things that we're going to experience in hell, too. Jesus called it the lake of fire. And that's not someplace I want to go water skiing. But it's just one of the powerful analogies that you use in this book. You say, Rick, that we as Christians who want to be effective apologists, evangelists, need to play our whole orchestra. What do you mean by that?
playing the whole orchestra means that I come to the, say, a friendship with a seeker or a skeptic, and I want my life to be wide. And I, not just being overweight, I want my life itself to have a whole bunch of different categories that all point to Jesus. So I might dabble in philosophy, and I might dabble in music, and I might dabble in literature and history, and I have a church community. And all these areas are different sections of the orchestra. So we might say that if I have a real heart for God and a heart for people, that might be the violins in my life. Well, am I going to let the violins play as I'm interacting with a friend who's not a Christian? Definitely. Well, let's say the intellect is the trumpet section. Am I going to let the trumpet section play in my life? Yes, it's both. It's balance. It's all of these things. I want to be a well-rounded person. And part of what that does, Bill, is that it defeats the stereotype of Christians as being very narrow. No, I want to read widely, and I want to be a cultured person, and I want the intellect to be important in my life. I value the mind, and I want my emotions to be well-developed and all of these things. So I want to play my whole orchestra when I'm with a person. And if you want to maybe change the analogy here just a touch, the apologetics section then of my life is one of the sections. It's the French horns, maybe. But the French horns are in concert with all the rest of my life, so that it's a concerted whole. And I think this sort of holistic approach to evangelism and apologetics is really powerful. And that way, Bill, we don't just isolate apologetics to some little section, obscure section of our lives. It's integrated into everything that we are.
And that is so critical, Rick, especially in this postmodern day. And so many young people, and I'm sure you experienced this on college campuses, both with the Christian kids and the non-Christian kids, what they want more than anything else is authenticity. They want transparency. They want real relationship. They don't want a phony. They want somebody who will be straight with them. But they're also looking for someone who will treat them with kindness and respect and caring, which, of course, is exactly what Jesus did. When he walked on this earth, and a great model. But when we become the guy with the rainbow hair holding up the John 3:16 sign, we're basically very unidimensional. And mm-hmm. you know, that is not appealing in this day and age, is it?
No. And if we're going to be true representatives of Jesus, then I think we can not only show love among ourselves, which, you know, Christians like doing, but Jesus called us to love our enemies as well. So when I walk on a college campus and I might walk into a secular atheist club and maybe I'm their invited guest for an afternoon or something, I'm saying to myself, well, if Jesus loves his enemies and has called me to love my enemies, the least I can do is at least show respect to these fine folks here, these atheists with whom I disagree, and try and show them not only a quality argument, but I want to show them a quality person that points to Jesus. And I just keep getting back to this ethic of love, not in some gushy sentimental sense, although I'm not against sentimental either, but something with a little bit more backbone than that, and that is to love those with whom we disagree. And I think that's the calling Jesus has given to us.
And, of course, we need the Holy Spirit's power to do that, especially when somebody is rubbing us the wrong way or is kind of one of those angry neo-atheists that we talked about earlier. Let's dive into a few of the other analogies that you – what are a few of your favorites that you have used and found to be very effective when you're evangelizing on college campuses?
Yeah, well, my mentor here at Bethel Seminary, where I attended, David Clark first suggested me the idea of, he says, don't blame the hammer. And I go, what do you mean by that? He goes, well, if I go out and pound dents in your car with a hammer, do you blame the hammer or do you blame the person? Well, I go, obviously, you blame the person. It's not the hammer's fault. Exactly. So when people blame religion for causing problems in our society, I guess I want to say to them, well, don't blame religion. Blame the people who have misused religion. In other words, don't blame the hammer. Blame the person who's misused the hammer. In fact, if you want to use the hammer rightly, if you want to redeem the hammer, go out and pound nails for Habitat for Humanity. There's lots of good uses for the hammer. But if you misuse the hammer, that's like misusing religion. And it's the person. It's not the thing itself. It's not the hammer. It's not the tool. It's not the religion. It's sinful people who misuse these things to bring harm to others. That's what we're against. I remember I said this to one of my friends one day, and she just looked at me and she said, "Wow, I never thought of it that way before."
Mm.
And her name is Jane. And I said, "Well, Jane, don't blame this. Yeah, Christians do bad things. I'm not disputing that. But it's the Christians themselves who have fallen into sin, perhaps, that have done the wrong thing here. It's not Christianity itself."
Mm.
So that's a really good one, and it's crisp, it's concrete. Don't blame the hammer. You can use it quickly in conversation, and it really gets you to the point.
So somebody brings up, let's say, the Crusades,
exactly,
or some other injustice that has been done by Christians. That's, you know, you're really blaming the hammer. It was the individuals. It was maybe the organized church at the time. It was the authorities. It wasn't Jesus Christ that caused that or wanted that to happen.
Right, and sometimes those weren't real Christians either. Those were not Christ followers doing those things. I mean, if they were, then maybe we should take some level of responsibility for our brothers and sisters who've caused harm. But sometimes these aren't actual Christ followers. So another analogy I have is if some people knock on your door and they have the uniform of police, and you invite them in, and then they tie you up and rob you blind, obviously they weren't the real police. Well, are you going to blame the real police here? Are you going to blame the real cops? No, these imposter cops are not the real thing. And that's an analogy I've used a lot to talk about people who've done things in the name of religion or done things in the name of Christianity who are not real Christians.
Hmm. Do you find it helpful when you point out to an atheist or agnostic how tough Jesus was on the religious authorities of his day? Because my guess is a lot of atheists, agnostics are not even familiar with the fact that he saved his harshest criticism for the quote-unquote religious.
You should come on the road with me, Bill. You've got my lines down totally here. Yeah, I often mention how Jesus was really against hypocrisy, and there's some good passages, especially in Matthew and in Mark, those two Gospels. There's some great passages in there that I sometimes quote or summarize and tell folks how Jesus criticized the religious establishment of the day for its hypocrisy. And Jesus is still doing that, and the religious establishment needs to listen to that. And I think that shows maybe a level of humility and honesty that I think atheists and other skeptics, they really respect. So, yeah, it's a good argument.
Mm. Our guest is Rick Mattson. He is the author of Faith is Like Skydiving. It is a new book out from InterVarsity Press. It's a book that you want to have if you want to become more effective in sharing your faith, because it really goes about it in a very different way from some of the more traditional forms of evangelism and apologetics. It's 11:45. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break, and if you'd like to enter our drawing for a copy of one of Rick's books, well, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. 877-93-FAITH. Give us your name, address, phone number, email, and we will put you into that drawing at the end of the hour. 877-93-FAITH is the number, and we'll take a quick break and be right back.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. We appreciate you joining us on this weekend, wherever you might be listening, perhaps in Madison, Wisconsin, Fargo-Moorhead, Duluth, Sioux Falls, Waterloo, or right here in the Twin Cities on Faith 900. Thank you, thank you, thank you for taking Faith Radio with you wherever you go. And we're talking to Rick Mattson today, the author of Faith is Like Skydiving and Other Memorable Images for Dialogue with Seekers and Skeptics. James Sire is the author of a classic worldview book called The Universe Next Door. Listen to what he says about this book. "Many books on apologetics do well with the arguments, but have little on how to present them. Faith is Like Skydiving combines reason with rhetoric, clarity with intellectual depth. It provides a vast array of arguments and a host of images to make those arguments clear and compelling. Intellectually sound and amazingly practical, this terrific book deserves widespread reading." Rick, those are some good words from James Sire.
I happen to know Dr. Sire a bit, and I felt very honored that he would write those things. He read the manuscript before it was published, and looked it over and gave me some good critique. And then, gave me a good reference. So I appreciate that.
Now, let me ask you this. Chapter 5 of your book asks this question. What is our best evidence for the life of Jesus, and how can we illustrate it?
Yeah. You know, I came up with this this acronym called MODEMS, M-O-D-E-M-S. And the different letters stand for different parts of the argument. Because what I found, Bill, is that when I get out on the road and I get in these tight spots and objections are flying at me from skeptics and so forth, I can't always remember my lines, and I can't remember how to organize them. So M-O-D-E-M-S helped me to organize my arguments for the historical Jesus. And I won't go through the whole argument, but I can just quickly summarize it here. M stands for monotheism. In other words, the early Jews, the first century Palestinian Jews, believed in just one God. They wouldn't invent what appeared to be a second God. They wouldn't invent Jesus. Rather, they discovered Jesus in their midst, much to their surprise. So that's the M, monotheism. And then O stands for overlapping material, and that's what historians look for. They look for converging lines of evidence. They look for multiple testimony, and that's what we have in the New Testament, a variety of authors saying the same thing. D stands for difference. There are certain differences in certain selection of details, for example, that the different writers about Jesus bring to the table, and the differences help make the case that Jesus really is a true historical figure. E stands for embarrassing material. There's things in the Gospels that if they were made up, if they were fantasy, the writers would never have put in there. For example, they probably wouldn't have put the fact in there that they fell asleep in the Garden of Gethsemane. If I was writing a story about Jesus and I was just making it up, and if I was putting myself in the story, I wouldn't say, oh, and I fell asleep in the Garden of Gethsemane. Oh, and another time he said, get behind me, Satan. You know, there's enough counterproductive material in the Gospels and enough embarrassing material in the Gospels that if you were just making it up, you wouldn't put that in there, which is an indicator that it's most likely true. So M-O-D-E, and then M stands for manuscripts. There's a whole manuscript tradition, over 5,700 ancient Greek manuscripts that enable us to get back to what was originally written about Jesus. M-O-D-E-M, and then finally S, Bill, in my little acronym here of MODEMS, S stands for secular sources. And there's about, a dozen or so secular sources, non-Christian sources that talk about Jesus. And I usually bring up two or three of those in my arguments. And that way you can kind of encapsulate this case for the historical Jesus in a way that hopefully my hearers can remember, but more importantly, when I'm on the spot, I can actually remember it. And that's part of the whole point here of coming up with analogies, is that you can remember them and you can use them on the fly. You don't have to think about them too hard.
Mm. And you unpack each of those more in more detail in the book, help your reader. We have what appears to be a conflict in this society between faith and science. I would say it's only an apparent conflict because I don't know if you heard what I said at the beginning of the program. I believe God is the great architect of creation, and he gives us those two sources of truth. He gives us his revealed word in Scripture and then his revealed word in nature in the way that he designed the world. And those two, when they appear to conflict, I believe that it's either one of two things. I believe either our theology is wrong and we've messed up there because we're fallen human beings and we have finite minds, or our science is wrong because, again, we're fallen human beings and we have finite minds and we failed to do something, in our research. It was confounded in some way by some element that messed it up. So when we find, for example, let me just give an example. It's a practical example. Recently, there have been some, and this has been widely reported in the media, that have said, the research shows that children raised by gay couples do just as well or even better than the children raised by straight couples. And, of course, you see that reported on ABC News or in USA Today, and you go, wow, Well, that seems to conflict, of course, directly with what Scripture would say about homosexuality. And, in fact, the research does not show that, because if you look beneath the surface, as did a sociologist from the University of Texas. If you look beneath the surface, that research was flawed in a variety of ways. So let's talk about that apparent conflict between faith and science and how you grapple with that when you're on a college campus.
Yeah, I usually present three models. One is the conflict model, our faith and science in conflict, and I agree with you, they're not. And the second model is, are they just in separate domains? In other words, they don't really overlap. Sometimes it's called non-overlapping magisterium, meaning that they just talk about different things. Science is the what and religion is the why. I don't really hold to that either. I sense you probably don't either. I think the two are integrated. I think they do harmonize, and we're misunderstanding one side or the other if they seem to conflict. And I guess I don't feel much threatened by that, Bill. I think life is, it's a long adventure of discovering God's truth, and God's truth is in science, and God's truth is in theology. And if there seemed to be some tension between the two, we need to dig deeper and pray harder and do more research and do our theology better so that the two will come into alignment, because there's only one God and there's only one ultimate truth, and all truth is God's truth. So in the example that you gave, yeah, we need to look at our theology, or we need to look at those studies. And you mentioned that perhaps if we looked beneath the study, there's some flaws in the way it was done. And another way I might at least ask about that study is, how are you defining doing better? Mm-hmm. If you're saying that children raised in certain environments are doing better than in other environments, well, what's the goal here? How do you define doing better? Can we come to an agreement on that? Mm-hmm. And until you do that, then you're going to be measuring apples against oranges here. And I think that's part of what I might say to a skeptic who brought that up to me on a college campus.
Mm. Rick, we just have about 3 minutes left. The hour has flown by, and I really, again, want to commend people to this book, Faith is Like Skydiving. Rick Mattson is the author. Let's dive into one or two more of the analogies quickly. Mm-hmm. The telephone game, why the Bible is not full of errors.
Yeah, I get this one all the time. Well, the Bible's been translated and retranslated over the centuries so that the copies we have now don't even resemble what was originally written. And the first thing I want to say is, well, how do you know that? And usually that will stop about 70 or 80% of the skeptics right in their tracks, because they'll say something like, well, I heard something on TV or, whatever. And that's about, the extent of their argument. And so, I think it's okay to press for some specifics, to say, well, if you can give me some specific examples of ways you think it's been changed, then we can look at those. But the telephone game analogy comes in where people think that Bible translation over the centuries and Bible copying over the centuries is just a matter of the telephone game. Like the first person whispers something to the second person, and then that's what gets a little bit distorted, and then the second person whispers in the ear of the third person in this game, and that gets distorted, until the 10th person down the line, says what the original phrase was supposed to be, and it's, hilarious result. And so people think that, all we had was just one line of copying all the way through the centuries, and that got changed, and then the next generation got changed and so forth, when in fact scholars have a whole variety of manuscripts to draw from. So where I turn the telephone game back on its head is I say, well, Bible translation isn't just one telephone game. It's 10 telephone games. Mm. And if you want to find out how one family of manuscripts that's come down to us from a certain location in the ancient world compares with another manuscript tradition that comes to us from the ancient world, with a third tradition and a fourth tradition, all you do is cross-compare these traditions. It's like cross-comparing 10 telephone games. And you can always get back to the original phrase if you've got 10 telephone games working with the same phrase all at once. So that's a little bit complicated. It's a little bit hard to summarize right here, in 30 seconds. But I think if you read it and memorize it and you're in a real conversation with a skeptic, it works pretty well.
Mm. Rick, we're out of time. Let me mention your website. It's Rick Mattson, MATTSON.blogspot.com. RickMattson.blogspot.com. We'll put that on our webpage at Faith Radio as well. Thank you for your time, Rick. May the Lord continue to guide you and direct you and bless you in your ministry on college campuses.
Bill, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Take care.
That's it for today. You have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. If you'd like more information about this show, you can visit our program page at myfaithradio.com.